we have on the call. Good morning, good afternoon, everybody. Michele Nilon, James Bladel, Barbara Steele, Anil George, Paul Diaz, Kevin Ertman, Eric Brown, Chris Chaplow, and Mikey O'Connor. And for staff, we have Marika Koenig, Olaf Nordling, and Glenda Sanjuri, myself. And we have apologies from Badwan Shombi.
Also apologies from Alain Doolan.
Alain Doolan. Thank you, Marika.
Thank you. James, are any of your sidekicks joining later?
I think you mean Tim?
Yeah.
I believe he's so powerful. I'm not aware. I assume so.
Okay. Right. Please be aware that today's call is 60 minutes because there's another call that some people have to jump on to at the top of the hour. Okay, then. So we just kick off. Has anybody got any other matters they want to bring to attention before we move on to the agenda? No? Deathly silence? Fine. Okay. RTP Part B public comment period update.
Yes, this is Marika. I just wanted to note that, well, as all of you will have seen, the public comment period is up and running. We've also sent out an announcement to the subscriber and the subscribers in the different languages of the policy update to do a bit more proactive outreach on this issue, as well as spreading the message to our global partnership team with the question to especially target those in other countries or in using different languages to take advantage of this opportunity to submit comments in one of the five UN languages that we're running the public comment period in. And my question is, if anyone's interested to get that email announcement in one of those languages, just drop me an email and I can forward it if you want to send it further around.
All right, thank you. So we've had a couple of comments already, I see.
Yes, but none in any of the UN languages, other languages yet. And what I've seen from a quick glance, they don't seem to specifically relate to the charter questions.
They very much concentrate on who is and pros and cons of doing various things with who is.
Oh, well, at least they're comments.
Yes.
I mean, come on, it could be worse. Even if the comments are irrelevant, they're comments.
That is not before.
The email announcement text is available in the other languages, is what you're saying?
Yes, because we've used that. We have a policy update that's also available in the different UN languages, and we thought in order to be a bit more proactive about it and target those people that might be interested in submitting comments, use the opportunity to send a note to them saying that, you know, this opportunity currently exists. So we've developed an email to that end that basically just translates the announcement and, you know, provides a link to where they can submit the comments.
Okay, perfect. Good. I personally welcome this idea. I'm very happy about it. Hopefully some people will take advantage of it, but at least they'll have had the option. Anybody else have anything to say about the public comment period? Are all the North Americans still fast asleep?
Well, here's a question from North America, not exactly on the public comment period, but I don't want to take too much time out of today's discussion, but I had an email exchange with the president of the IPC constituency, and I'll just say that the discussion was about whether working group members should participate in the drafting of advocacy positions by various constituency groups. And I didn't know if anyone on the call has a view towards what the policy is on that.
Sorry, this is Glenn. Could you please say your name when you speak, because this makes the transcript easier to read. Thank you.
Yeah, this is Kevin Erdman from North, one of the waking North Americans.
I see Marika's got her hand up and James. As Marika's a lady, we'll let her go first.
Well, thank you, although I think James had his hand up first. Just a note, I think from the staff perspective, there's no procedure or policy on that. I know that some of the constituencies actually request that the people that are involved in the working group contribute or would like them to contribute, of course, because they have already some insight, knowledge, and exposure to the issues that are on the table. So that's, you know, just what I can share from my perspective. But I would hope that, you know, James and some of the other members of constituencies are able to share a bit more how the process works in their constituencies.
And this is James. I just wanted to mention that I think each constituency has their own internal procedures on how formal or how coordinated their constituency statements are, whether it's a formal statement or whether it's more of an informal document. And, I think it's whether it's a designated person who's representing that constituency on the group or whether it's just a coming together of various folks who have participated on the group and want to have some input into the into the statement, I think it's really up to the individual constituencies. But my question is there... Was the IPC concerned that was some sort of a conflict, or I'm trying to understand what the concern was?
Well, I don't really have much of a feeling either way, except in the case, you know, for example, if a member of the working group was representing a party that had a real interest, you know, an economic or legal interest in getting a policy crafted one way or another, I think that would pose some difficulties at, you know, being part of the working group. You know, I mean, I think whenever we get in a discussion and a party, one of the members is involved with a party that does have some sort of real vested interest in the discussion, we'll disclose that as part of their, you know, discussion, but I would be disinclined to say that, well, gee, if I represented, let's say, Microsoft, and Microsoft definitely wanted to do XYZ on this policy, and I crafted and I wrote, you know, a position paper that they submitted as, you know, for whatever their constituency was, I wouldn't feel that would be appropriate to then be a part of the, you know, working group panel that considered that position statement. But that's my only concern about it.
Sorry, I'm Michele here. I'm trying to follow the logic here, and I'm getting a little bit confused. You're suggesting that people who have some form of interest in the policy shouldn't be on the working group. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, basically.
Okay, so how would you expect there to be a functioning working group if people don't have some interest in the policy?
Well, I'm not saying that they don't have some interest, but what I'm saying is that, you know, from my perspective, this is, again, Kevin Erdman, just say from my perspective, if you are in position of advocating a resolution of a policy item, then it doesn't seem to me that you should be on the panel that's making the adjudication on that item. You know, to the extent that you have experience in it, and you can, you know, comment on why things might be smoother or not smoother or better or worse. But if you have if you've taken a real, you know, economic commitment to get a result, I think that's what I'd consider the differentiating factor. So that you can have mean, obviously everybody who's involved in the business of registering, transferring, owning domain names has some sort of an interest in the, you know, functioning of the system. But to the extent that you have, you or your the organization that you represent has a real conflict on the resolution of a particular issue, I feel it's not appropriate then to be part of the panel making that decision.
Okay. There's several hands up here. I'm going to take the, I'm not too sure which order people put their hands up in, so I'm going to choose people at random, so please don't be offended. We'll take Mikey, Arnold, James, and Marika. Is your hand back up again, or did you just forget to take it down the last time?
No, I put it up again.
Okay. I let you go first last time, so this time you're last. Sorry.
Okay.
Who did I say was first? Arnold, I think, didn't I?
Okay.
Or Arnold.
Guys, this is Anil.
Anil, sorry.
No problem. I'm a rep for the ICC here. I just differ with Kevin's point of view. I was on the email exchange with Kevin, and I think it's more, I think his personal reflection on the issue, which I respect. I think from our perspective, or at least from the president of the ICC, I think his point of view was more consistent with James's earlier point, which was we have a certain insight into the issues that we're dealing with. So if you're on the working group, in your involvement to that extent that you have knowledge about the real issues there is helpful.
Okay, thank you. Next up, we Mikey.
This is Mikey. I guess I bet Marika is going to explain this to us in a minute, but I assume that when I fill out the statement of interest that I'm disclosing those conflicts, and that once disclosed, then I carry on in terms of, you know, I'm with Michaela on this one. I think if you don't have an interest in the policy at hand, you're probably not going to be terribly effective as a work group member. I mean, that's the whole point, is to have that conversation.
Okay, thank you. And James?
Yeah, thanks, Michaela. This is James. And I just wanted to, because I think there might be a danger that we could go off track off the agenda on this, and I just wanted to make a couple of quick comments. The first being that, you know, we are not referring necessarily to the various factions or subdivisions of the GNSO as constituencies. We are calling them stakeholder groups, I think, for a reason, because the folks participating in these working groups have a stake in the outcome, whether it's a business stake or a stake in privacy advocacy or whatever the particular stakeholder group is advocating. I think that rather than try to eliminate that, I think it's best to be transparent about that, and that's why we had the statements of interest and the constituency statements, et cetera. And then the final thing I wanted to mention was just that I don't feel that working groups or PDPs, at least the ones I've been involved in up to this point, are adjudicating or deciding on policy necessarily so much as crafting policy recommendations to the GNSO Council, which then I think ultimately has the final, at least, opportunity to make a decision of whether or not that that policy goes forward. So I don't really see us necessarily as a as a group of stakeholders coming in to write our own regulations or whatever the word might be. I just see us as coming together as bringing a disparate and diverse areas of expertise into a forum where we can craft recommendations to the council. So that's just my take on that.
Thank you.
But Marika? I don't mean to take us off track, so I apologize.
Yeah, this is Marika. I think most of what I wanted to say has already been said by James and by Mikey. Just one point to add. I know that one of the things that's being discussed currently as part of the whole reform process of the GNSO is as well a requirement to have a disclosure of interest at time of votes or decision-making processes, and that might address part of that concern where, you know, people clearly state, which they should have already done as well in their statement of interest, when certain decisions are taken that they clearly state whether they have a specific interest in the outcome of that, and then it's clear and obvious for everyone where everyone stands and, you know, have a transparent process.
And Mikey, you had your hand up again?
Oh, no, I'm sorry, I forgot.
More coffee, more coffee. Come on there.
I'm drinking the stuff with caffeine in it and everything. I don't know what's wrong.
Is there any other kind of coffee?
No,
actually, don't go over
there.
Has anybody else got anything to say on this slight side topic before we move on? I'll take the silence to mean no. Okay, then. Next item on the agenda, finalise initial discussion on issue A, whether a process for urgent return slash resolution of a domain name should be developed as discussed within the SAC hijacking report. So, any comments, thoughts, or views? Okay, Paul Diaz.
Thanks, Michele. Just a question. When we say finalize, I mean, I assume we're just... the focus should be on initial discussion, right?
Oh, yeah.
Really, we're not closing
it.
Anything off. Cause,
no,
it seems... okay, understood. I just wanted to make sure because it seemed that a lot of our discussion to date was, in fact, talking about the transfer dispute resolution policy. We kicked that around a lot, and that wasn't necessarily explicitly cited in our charter, but it seemed a natural flow from this particular issue. And personally, I'm not sure if we really had a very robust discussion about a specific urgent return policy. We were talking about potentially tweaking another existing one. I just wanted to make sure that for, you know, moving forward that we can certainly come back and more fully address these issues, in particular after the initial public comments were received.
Okay. Mikey?
I guess my question is, do we have the word finalized sort of tweaked my attention as well. Do we have a draft that we're working from? I'm a little... maybe it's just the coffee today. Who knows? But I'm not feeling like we've really had that discussion or gotten anything down on paper, but...
I think this is partially my fault because I was sent a draft agenda for today and the word finalized didn't really upset me. I'll be more careful in future. I'm going to let Marika jump in there because I have a sneaking suspicion she's going to say something pertinent to this.
She's pretty smart. She usually does.
Yes, yeah. Correct. The reason why I put our finalized initial discussion is that on the last meeting, we briefly discussed whether the group already wanted to talk about recommendations at this stage or whether, you know, we would prefer to go through the different questions and have initial discussions and then following the public comments and the constituency statements, then have the more in-depth discussion and move more in the direction of discussing potential recommendations for each of these issues. So that's why I put there finalized the initial discussion, indeed, you know, as Paul took it as, you know, just wrapping up the initial exchange that is not yet the in-depth discussion that is probably needed to come to some kind of recommendations or conclusions on it, which hopefully will follow following the public comments and the constituency statements. That was the idea behind it. And apologies if that caused any confusion.
Thanks, Marika. Mikey, does that kind of answer your question?
Well, I guess I'm going to leave my hand up on purpose this time. I guess I've got sort of a process question. You know, we're sort of climbing a mountain, and it's kind of nice to drive a stake in the ground at certain stages up the path. And the initial discussions that we've had have been pretty wide-ranging, but I'm not sure I understand how we're capturing those and doing... If you view sort of a rough draft as a stake in the ground, are we producing rough drafts along the way, or are we just having conversations at this point?
I'm taking notes.
She's taking notes.
I'm happy as well to, you know, to put some notes down on, you know, each of the subjects that we cover that the group then can use, you know, for the next phase to go back and see what did we talk about again and what were some of the ideas that came up. I'm happy, for example, to create some wiki pages for each issue so members have as well an opportunity to add anything, you know, I might have forgotten or ideas they come up with and want to park somewhere for when we come back to the issue, if that would be helpful.
I think all of that would be helpful so that then when we get to an agenda item like this one, we can take a look at something and see sort of the ground we've already covered and you know, tidy it up, I guess. Thanks. That would be great, Marika.
Okay.
Okay, and there's another hand up there. Chris Chaplow.
Thank you, yes. I was just wondering if one stake that we could put in the ground or at least throw it on the table, looking at the word urgent return resolution, could that be defined as if the DNS has been changed? Is that something that we can focus on or can ask what people think about that?
Can I say one thing from my own personal perspective? I wouldn't see the DNS as being the only issue for a matter of urgency. If somebody were to change the details of a domain belonging to me personally or to my company, the DNS resolution would be the least of my concerns, personally, speaking personally.
Chris, again, if the DNS hasn't changed, then it's sort of still an administrative problem, isn't it? The moment the DNS changes, then it becomes a real practical problem and urgency is required.
I disagree with you, because if the contact details on the domain change to that of a third party, then I lose control of the domain. I can't make any changes to it. And by the time, so if I don't do something about that when I notice it, what am I going to do then? Because I'm completely snookered.
Then you can use the policies that are already in place.
Yeah, but I think you're missing my problem. I can change DNS servers on a .com domain a couple of hundred times per day without very little effort.
Yeah.
So surely if the details of the domain change without the DNS being affected, that should be enough to cause me a major headache. Because once the DNS, it's very easy for somebody to change the DNS backwards and forwards. You mightn't even notice that it's happened.
But if we're looking at the transfer combined with the change of DNS, is that not the events that could trigger a new policy?
I don't have an answer for that one. Mikey?
I think maybe you're confusing... I'm with Michele on DNS isn't the right target. And I think, Michele, the words you used were contact information. I think it's the change in the information about the control of the domain, not so much the DNS. The DNS is sort of a...
Well, yeah, this is the other thing. I mean, just coming back to this thing of the DNS, what are you referring to in DNS? Do you mean A records, MX records, or name servers? Or do you mean all of them? Or do you only mean one of them?
I suppose I would mean all of them, because it means either the email or the website has been hijacked.
Well, yeah, but okay. If I were to insert, say, 25 A records for a particular domain name, and I was to drop the TTL on the zone file down to, say, 60 seconds, I would then effectively be able to round-rob on the website via multiple places. I could probably do it in such a manner that it would be almost impossible for you to notice that I've done it. Because all I have to do is put in, say, if I put in, say, 100 A records, I can put in, say, 85 to 90 that are valid and put in one or two that you mightn't notice are actually invalid.
Yeah.
And how are you going to monitor that?
I don't know, I'm just thinking of, we're looking to cite, do we need a policy above what we've already got, i.e. the registrars talking to each other, or the inter-register transfer policy? I'm just looking for a definition, something to trigger that we should actively come up with something, that was all.
Oh, yeah,
but
no,
I'm not hung on it. I'm just trying to throw in something in there to try and help us.
Oh, yeah, no, I mean, don't worry on this. I just wonder where we came from. Mikey, thoughts? Your hands are still up.
This is Mikey. Yes, I did actually put my hand up again. I think that the key phrase just popped out, which is, what, if anything, is the trigger for the need for an urgent return? That's part of the reason why I was scratching my head earlier about the notes, because we've talked a fair amount about this, and I've forgotten which parts of it we've talked about, and I've forgotten the process that we described, and, you know, James and Barbara and Paul can help me out here. There are several things. One is we have to be careful not to jump outside of our scope. We're really only talking about the inter-registrar transfer process, not all hijackings. And I think that by stepping back from DNS servers as the thing to focus on, but rather to brainstorm a little bit about what the trigger would be that we might be able to get to something. But I can't even really remember where we got to in previous discussions about the need for a policy at all as part of the reason why I think the notes would be so helpful.
Marika? You've got a better memory than me.
Yeah, I don't think we really went into that in that much detail. I know that was, you know, some of the questions that staff put out in the issues report, like, how big of a problem is hijacking? Does it warrant any policy changes? And, of course, as well, the question, how do you define hijacking and who's, in the end, you know, the judge of whether there's the need for the urgent return? So I think we look more at the TRP and seeing how that process is being used and then discuss more issues relating to that. I don't recall that we went into great depth of discussing, you know, what event or what situation would warrant an urgent return, and would that warrant the development of a new policy. I think we had some discussion as well that, you know, a lot of these situations are currently resolved, you know, between dialogue between registrars. So the question there is as well, you know, the situation where it is required, is that helped by a new policy, or what might it, you know, deter or limit the availability of possibilities that registrars have to solve these issues between them.
Okay. James?
Yeah, I think I just wanted to echo some of what Marika was saying, that the trigger in my, you know, initial take from reading this question would be, the trigger for this process would be that the registrant has contacted the registrar believing that there has been or claiming that that a recent transfer was not authorized and was likely hijacking attempt. And that, you know, right now I think that there's a great deal of confidence that if this were to occur between, let's say, I'm going to pick on Paul a little bit, if this were to occur between GoDaddy and Network Solutions, I think there's a lot of confidence that our two teams will work together to sort that sort of thing out. The concern is that when we're dealing with a registrar that's either not readily contactable or isn't responsive or doesn't agree with that, that there's be some sort of an escalation process or an alternative method to undoing that transfer that the registrant claims was unauthorized. And now the second question is, how does that differ from the TDRP as it exists today? And I'm afraid I don't have a short answer for that. But that was my read on this particular question, and apologize if I'm not interpreting that correctly.
I see another hand up there, Kevin.
Yeah, I just wanted to make the comment that Now, it seems to me that the that folks that are fairly active in the industry have a good ability to resolve some of the problems of hijacking or other inappropriate transfers. But it's my sense that what is trying to be accomplished is to protect the, you know, a part, you know, let's just say, you know, that there's a big retailer that has their big domain where they get most of their traffic, and somehow something goes wrong with their domain, and it's a, you know, large economic impact on them, and they want to have, you know, the ability to have a quick resolution of whatever they see their problem is, and it may be a party that doesn't have quite the experience and sophistication in the technical aspects of the transfer protocols, and may in fact, you know, just be a victim of a hijacking or be a victim of some other blundering of registries. And it seems to me that's the real key to, you know, whether enough of those happen that it makes sense to put forward the you know, the extra protocol.
Okay. Anybody else got anything to add? No? Okay. So based on what we've been discussing so far, what we're looking for is some agreement on what triggers this. And based on what a couple of registrars have said, the trigger would appear to be when the registrant contacts the losing registrar. Is that correct, James? James?
I'm sorry. Say that once more, please.
Oh, okay. God, it came out so well the first time. Based on what we're trying to decide on, what is the trigger for any form of policy or any action? And what you were saying is that the trigger at the moment would be when the registrant contacts the registrar. Is that correct?
Yes, I believe that this would be initiated by a claim of hijacking.
Okay.
Or whether or not that's a valid claim, I guess is it's initiated by a claim.
Well, let's just try and put some suggestions of something out there. We can thrash out the finer details afterwards. Mikey, do you want to argue with that or suggest an alternative?
Well, I'm wondering, you know, I'm wondering whether the trigger is that, or is it the next stage?
What's the next stage?
Process, which is where the registrars and registrants involved bump into a non-responsive opposite party. So is the trigger, you know, because I'm going to make up numbers because I don't know
how many.
But let's say that there are 1,000 instances that GoDaddy and Network Solutions bonk into in a year. And 990 of them, they get resolved between themselves without invoking this. And that the triggering event is the inability for that informal process to resolve it. So, I'm fine with James's triggering.
Okay.
But I'm not sure whether we need to trigger a policy every time this happens or whether it's when escalation is required that this is the trigger.
James, I see your hand waving there.
Yes, and this is, I think that the last sentence Mikey said was the pertinent one. The word trigger to me implies an automated process, and I don't think that this is, the intention was that this would be an automated process so much as an escalation process for registrars and registries to work together should the existing tools or options they have to recovering a hijacked name, if those were to fail, then this is another approach. So I'm thinking that the word trigger, to me, implies something that's happening or that is compelled, a registrar is compelled to do or a registry is compelled to do but I don't think that that's really what we're getting at. We're talking about a tool or a procedural option that can be used in the event that existing tools fail.
Okay, so basically we're talking about the option existing for people to take advantage of it, should they wish.
Now, when I say when you say people, if you mean registrars,
right.
Yes.
I say something simple, and God, it gets analyzed.
I
okay.
know. Well, my concern, McKelly, is that, and I'm sorry, this is James speaking again, is my concern would be that a registrant would say, hey, my name has been hijacked, and it's now at Network Solutions, and I say, well, let me call my good friend Paul, and we'll get this straightened out. The registrant saying, no, I want you to... I want to compel you to execute this process, and it could be longer and more expensive when it's just a simple phone call to another registrar would have sorted it out in minutes.
That's a very valid point, and I apologize. Okay, Paul has had his hand up. I think he's running away now.
No, James just clarified it, so I'm fine, McKelly. Thank you.
Yeah, so did,
okay.
So did I. This is Mikey.
Okay, so... how can we possibly word this so that you don't end up in a situation where registrants or registrants overpaid lawyers or whoever are wasting everybody's time and causing headaches for everybody by triggering processes or whatever that aren't necessary? Okay. Mikey, again. Kevin again. Let's choose Kevin this time.
Yeah, I was just going to suggest that I think the way to keep the amount of requests for this expedited procedure to a reasonable amount so that there's a reasonable likelihood that the procedure was actually needed would be to put up the requirements for invoking the procedure to be something that's relevant to the problem and also objectively determinable, because this isn't a situation like the UDRP where there's judgment involved and it takes a bunch of time and panels and all that, where if you want something to be done fast, then the criteria for deciding whether you ought to do it ought to be fairly objective, and maybe it's not a trigger such that it's completely automated, but it at least ought to be something that is readily ascertainable and not a matter of judgment.
Okay. Mikey?
I like all of that. I think triggering is just the wrong word. We could call it circumstances or almost anything to avoid the automation thing. And I think that the key to this is some sort of documentation that reasonable prior efforts have already been made and failed and that the process needs to be expedited. And then I like Kevin's notion of delineating what that description would be. I'm not sure we need to define it on this call, but we can certainly come up with a list of those things.
Silence. Barbara Steele, hello.
Hi. I'm wondering if it makes sense for all registrars to have available to their registrants an escalation contact method, whether it be an email that's monitored very closely. I'm not sure that it needs to be 24/7, but perhaps it is if it's a very high value name, or a telephone number where registrants who have found their names have been hijacked can call, and all registrars would be required to have that and have individuals who are committed to trying to resolve the problem, because I really do think that this is something that is most quickly resolved, and obviously time is of the essence in this particular case, at the registrar level.
Okay, I'm going to...
Can I jump in and respond to that, McKenna?
I was hoping... Yes, please do.
Yes, it's Paul Diaz for Network Solutions. just wanted to, at least in our experience, won't speak for all registrars, but I mean, we offer 24/7 customer experience, customer service, I should say. All of our reps are trained to understand if somebody has a problem like this to immediately move the call over to an escalation team, and we handle this all the time, literally around the clock. We would not be in favor of a specific publishing a specific escalation number, because we all know then everybody will call and say that their issue is escalation worthy. You know, so at least in our case, I mean, we're there round the clock, 365 days a year, and deal with these issues as they come in. Agree with Barbara that, you know, this is registrars are the first line of defense to respond, and I would also remind folks that with the changes in the registration accreditation agreement, registrars are required now to provide their contact information explicitly on their sites. Anybody who's not doing that and therefore not making themselves available to deal with one of these urgent situations, you know, I would say then it's really an issue for ICANN compliance to weigh in and to address that, because that would be a failing on the part of the registrar meeting the provisions of the RAA.
Chris, Chapo?
Yeah, just thinking really where we are, we're looking like we need, first of all, to have a transfer and then changing control of the domain, and then the registrant contacting, or the old registrant contacting the losing registrar, and then at some point, possibly, if they're getting absolutely no response from the losing registrar, or at some point when, although the losing registrar is assuring them that they're doing everything they can to resolve this registrar to registrar, there is some form of escalation. And how exactly that gets triggered, or if it ever happens at all, that's sort of where we are, isn't it?
This is Mikey. I'd like to jump in on that one real quick.
Please do. Please do.
I think that there's really two people that escalate. One is the registrant, as you describe it, Chris, and the other is the registrar. So the circumstance that Paul and James might describe is we've been contacted by the losing registrant, but we can't get a response from the gaining registrar. And it's not clear to me whether there are two initiators of this escalation process or whether there are two different processes depending on who's initiating. But I think there are two parties that might initiate this escalation, the registrar and the registrant.
Marika?
Yes, this is Marika. I had a question in relation to the comment that Kevin made on having objectively determinable factors in deciding whether a hijacking is taking place or not. And I was wondering, like, for the registrars on the call, how do you make that assessment in those discussions you have? How do you make that assessment that it's indeed a hijacking that has gone on? And are there some elements that this group can take into consideration as, you know, what boxes need to be ticked for such an urgent process to be triggered, if such factors exist?
Could I add a few words? This is Olaf. To be the certainty, because somewhere there's a need to be certain that the transfer has happened incorrectly, and that the to avoid that there are frivolous attempts from a previous owner of a domain to get it back, even though it may be, have been, for example, we talked briefly, if there's been a divorce, for example, and, well, this has been gone to one of the parties, let's say, and the other party is still contesting it. So there is a need of some proof from the registrant that this is still his valid, his property. I think that's one of the gating factors as well.
James?
thanks, McKelly, and I think part of the conversation is starting to touch on an area of how do registrars resolve disputes between two competing claims for control of a domain name. And I'm of the opinion that that's starting to trace a little bit outside of what this question is focused on. This question, to me, is an indication of the same criteria or burdens of proof that we would use in attempting to undo any transfer as it stands today. We would presumably require for this new process. So I just wanted to get that out there. So this is a return to a status quo prior to an event occurring, so prior to a transfer. If there's a dispute or something like that, then I think that transfer is probably the last thing we want occurring in the middle of a dispute. So we should probably, maybe take that off the page and say this is essentially a reset previous to a transfer. If there's any kind of a differing claims, that those be settled as they were in the status quo prior to the transfer. I apologize if that didn't make any sense.
It didn't make any
sense. I understood it.
Okay. Sometimes I talk in circles. I'm a better writer than a talker, sorry.
Well, I'm used to dealing with the .ie CCTLD, so I'm kind of used to people talking in circles. Don't even go there, please. We'll be here all day.
Yeah, I'm going to just get started.
Yeah.
So I guess my bottom line point here is that we shouldn't be looking at this as a means to resolve disputes. This is a policy or a tool or an option to resolve transfers.
This is Mikey, this is only to resolve inter-registrar transfers. Otherwise, we're also stepping outside our scope.
Yeah.
Absolutely correct, Mikey.
Okay, so we need to be careful. So basically, to see if I can summarize what people have said. I'm trying to keep this kind of focused and clear, because otherwise my poor little head is going to explode. The policy should not be abused for reasons other than for which it is designed, if such a policy is required. So it's to do with hijacking, not with other types of disputes. So if I have a falling out with my business partner, then it's really outside the realm of this policy. Will people agree with that?
Yep.
Yeah.
Okay,
yep.
Fine. There are policies that exist for other types of disputes, and they should be used for that, and that people should not be trying to use to abuse a policy which is designed for... Oh, God, I'm beginning to have the same problem James is having. People say policy.
Write notes for it.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, that basically shouldn't be abused. It's to serve a particular type of situation and not other ones. The question, of course, I would ask is how can you possibly safeguard against that? It's a horrible question to ask, but...
This is Mikey.
Yes.
I think what we do is maybe we do let Marika summarize the discussion from the MP3 and solve that one after we've seen in a little bit clearer detail what we're talking about. I think there are ways to do it, but I think it'd be good to get the underlying premise laid out first.
Okay. Any other thoughts? Oh, James and Marika's hands are up. Okay, I'll let Marika go because she might say something really cool. Marika.
Well, there's pressure now.
World.
Listening to the discussion, it seems to come back to, like, can you have objective criteria with which you can identify whether concerns are hijacking or not? And if you would be able to identify those, you can avoid abuse because people need to tick the different boxes and I guess, provide proof of those certain elements so that, you can identify that it's indeed a hijacking. Of course, the big question is, do those identifiers exist? And are they objective, or would that require, a judgment or determination by a certain person or body or institution that can be challenged again by others. So I think that's, in the end, what the question will come down to, in my view.
All right, just on my own personal thing before I let James go through, I'd agree with you, Marika, in that the objective thing is going to be a lot of fun to resolve or to arrive at some kind of set of objective tests. It's like I see that as being quite interesting. James?
Kelly, and thanks for this. I just want to emphasize once again that I think the question that was posed earlier, perhaps by Mikey, was, is it possible to design an anti-hijacking mechanism and not have it be abused for reverse hijacking, if you're familiar with those types of terms? And I think that the very short off-the-cuff answer that I have is, again, we are talking about restoring a situation to exactly the environment that it was in pre-transfer. I think the lawyers perhaps on the group can help me articulate this, but it's very similar to the concept of injunctive relief, where you want to get, you believe something harmful has occurred and you want to restore it to the situation that it was prior to that harm occurring. So I don't necessarily think that there is a concern that this would be used for reverse hijacking because you're restoring it back to the ownership that it was prior to the transfer. And secondly, I don't think that we need to write into the policy different burdens of proof or thresholds or hoops that a registrant has to go through. I think that those are already in place now, and as far as I know, there's not a whole lot of controversy over this, is that a registrant had an account with a registrar, they had a domain in their account, and now it's gone. I think that's a fairly objective level of proof there. So just putting that out on the table for discussion.
Kevin?
Yeah, my thought on the injunction aspect is I don't think the purpose of this procedure is to necessarily restore. I mean, that may be the ultimate objective of the party requesting the process, but I think the objective of the quick resolution is to maintain the status quo to allow for the correction if a correction is appropriate. So it seems to me that the procedure would really be two steps, which would be a first step, which is for the recipient of the, for lack of a better word, of the request, to be able to determine if the criteria that we're going to put in our recommendations, that criteria has been met, prevent further work on any further processing of that domain, and then have a stage two, which is to then see if everything else is in order to grant the request and then return things to the status quo, because unless we can set forth a criteria which just requires absolutely no consideration and would automatically return the domain to them, then we're really, and maybe that's a question that we need to resolve here first, which is it a one-step process, which is you meet the criteria, everything gets pushed back to where it was before, or number one, you meet the criteria and everything gets frozen, and then there's a process to make sure that if that's the correct result, and then reverse the transfer and restore the status quo.
This is Mikey. I want to jump in real quick on this one.
I think I'm going to have to. You have to make it really, really quick, Mikey.
I just want to highlight that this is urgent return, not urgent freeze. I really don't want to see us freeze this, because then the person who needs their domain back really quick could wind up losing it for months. That's it.
Okay, that's a good point. Guys, time-wise, we're a bit, we've run out of time. If people want to follow up with any other points on this, could they please do so via the mailing list? And the next call is when, Marika? Next week again, is it? Or 2 weeks?
In 2 weeks' time, in principle. We said bi-weekly, unless people would like to change to a weekly schedule.
Okay. Now, if people feel that we need to move to a weekly schedule, just shout now or forever hold your peace.
No one forever holds their peace in working.
Yeah, I've kind of noticed that, but hey, I was living in hope. Okay, so in 2 weeks again, if people have anything else, could they please post it to the mailing list? And Marika is going to do some wonderful things, and we think she's wonderful. And I'll speak to some of you probably later on the call, on another call today. Okay, thank you, Marika. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.